Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, a while back, we did something a little unusual. Normally, on American Variety, as you know, we have a guest talking about a particular topic for half an hour. But what I did a little while back was to do something different called Good News Week, which was just me reading stories that are positive. And, you know, the news is mostly negative or stressful in one way or another, for one group or another. And kind of the anti-theme of American Variety Radio is anything but politics. And a lot of the news that's disturbing or stressful is political in nature. And there's very little attention given to all the good things that happen in the world. So I did this show a few months back and asked people to write me on email and tell me whether they liked the concept or not. And I got quite a lot of positive responses of people saying, yeah, that was a good idea. I enjoyed it. It was kind of uplifting, you know. And I didn't get any negative responses. I kind of thought I might, actually. But so I'm going to try it again. Anyway, Good News Week. And what I'm doing is reading stories from off the world's internet, right? And a lot of them are from websites that do this kind of thing where I've kind of picked them up and gotten permission to use them. One is called Heroic Stories, and it's at heroicstories.com. So I'm just going to plunge in. This one's called Elves on a Ladder Truck, and it's by someone sent in by someone named Thomas Horn, who lives in Maryland. This was right around Christmas in 2008. He says, our firehouse ambulance was racing in response to a baby being shaken out a window, three stories in the air. Police were also en route. Dispatch relayed that the baby was being used to extort money from the mother. On arrival, we indeed saw a baby being waved out a window by his feet, three stories up. As we ran up the stairs, my partner said, distract the guy for a minute, I'll get the baby. A crying five-year-old child opened the door. He's hurting my brother. I entered, speaking as calmly as I could. Wild-eyed, the assailant said, don't touch me, copper, I smashed the brat. I said, I'm a firefighter, I only want to check the baby. Suddenly, a pair of hands appeared and grabbed the child. From the apartment's kitchen, my driver had gone out the window and reached across to grab the child out of the bad guy's hands, three stories up. Wild Eyes looked at his now empty hands, charged past me and escaped. So breathing raggedly, I surveyed a desperately bleak room, one bare bulb, broken furniture, an empty drawer for a crib. My partner came in holding the baby very close to himself, saying over and over, he's all right, he's all right. We gathered up mother and two other children. Downstairs, we met an army of police officers. As we loaded up the family, the officers took the perpetrator's description. With the madman's picture etched into my brain, I described him from top to bottom. After transporting the family to Children's Hospital, we took another call. When the officers caught the assailant, he fought, bruised two officers, and ended up needing stitches himself. Back at the station, a senior firefighter asked me for every detail. When I finished, he said, you can't fix the world, but you can mend parts of it, and got our shift together. We have a family to care for, he said. It's Christmas Eve. Most stores are closed, we chorused. The captain replied, I think this shift could pull it off on Christmas Day. No one argued any further. Groups of us went to the grocery, a toy store, and a child care supply store. Between us, we assembled Christmas for a family that needed everything. Next item, the only unpurchased Christmas tree left from our department's tree sale fundraiser. The crew shortened that poor scraggly thing and trimmed it to a decent shape. A 24-hour pharmacy yielded lights and ornaments. We called the hospital and found the baby's evaluation would take several more hours. The family would be sent home in the morning. At 11 p.m., we were finally ready, but back at the apartment building, the apartment door had a double-cylinder jimmy-proof lock, so we laddered up the apartment outside and hauled all the supplies up the ladder. Two different police officers came by with more items. We all agreed that at least for one day, the baby's brother and sister, and yes, even his mom, could believe in Santa Claus. Again, that was from heroicstories.com. Here's another one. It's called Call Me Grandpa by Rick Norton, who lives in California. Dad's life seemed typical of his generation. He graduated from high school during the Depression and worked for a large corporation. He enlisted in 1941, served in the Pacific and Europe. On returning, he met his soulmate, married, and had three children. Again at his prior employer, he needed to continue his education. With his full-time job, home maintenance, and attending to his family, he attended college in the evening and obtained his BS degree summa cum laude. With we three kids on our own, Dad and Mom retired to the Florida Panhandle. 2 years later, Mom died in 1990. Northwest Florida has no palm trees or yachts. It's semi-agricultural. Education is often a luxury with attendant illiteracy. Dad rattled around his house, tried golf, and failed to see why some become addicted to it, then saw an ad requesting literacy volunteers. Dad helped a prisoner learn to read, a parole requirement. He helped another man learn to read because his literate wife was going blind. Then he found his true calling. Dad began as a volunteer teacher's aide in a third-grade class, helping children with spelling and grading papers. He graduated to the fifth grade, helping with spelling and math. Again, Dad graduated with his class into sixth grade. As the school converted to departmental teaching, Dad assisted the math teacher. We kids only knew what Dad told us. During chilly winters, he lamented unfortunate kids in just T-shirts and shorts. He was saddened by children with nothing under the Christmas tree. He loved the kids in school and hated summers, so he tutored. Called Grandpa, he even wore a hat emblazoned, "Call me Grandpa." He said the kids kept him young. At 88, after 10 years commuting 30 miles to school in his sputtering 1979 Chevy, his legs weakened, he was admitted to a rehabilitation center for physical therapy to improve his muscle tone. One spring afternoon, during a nap, Dad passed away peacefully. At his memorial service, his students eulogized him with a 15-minute video tribute. They compared him to George Bailey in It's a Wonderful Life for the 1,200 student lives he touched. He inspired his kids to learn. At the reception, we heard, "Thanks to your dad, my son got his first A in math," and "My son won the spelling bee," and "My daughter won the citizenship award." Plus, none of his kids came to school in winter without at least one pair of pants, a warm shirt, and a jacket. Nor did Santa miss any house, despite Dad's fixed income. He received numerous awards from the state of Florida, the county, and the schools. The Chamber of Commerce named him Citizen of the Year. We found newspaper clippings and videotapes of TV interviews. His work was done without fanfare, from the richness of his heart. I hope to live as long, die as peacefully, and leave half the legacy. I also hope his life inspires you as it has me. And again, that's from Heroic Stories. Their mission is to use the power of the internet and existing media to bring diverse international voices to the world to explore the idea that people are good, that individuals and individual action matter, and that regularly showing examples of people being good to each other will inspire similar actions in others. So that's what we're trying to do here on Good News Week, here in the holiday period. Hope you're enjoying it so far. Here's another one. Following a hunch. This one comes from someone who just called themselves the Caroler in California. In 1997, as was our family tradition, my husband and I invited children from the local high school, a cappella choir, including our son, to sing Christmas carols to people we felt could use some special Christmas cheer. My husband dressed up as Santa Claus and drove a rented flatbed truck. The group tied our spinet piano in the flatbed truck, and Santa called, "All aboard!" Bundled up, we filled the truck with excited carolers. A woman from our church played the piano as we drove and sang. It was cold and windy for Southern California. We first caroled for an 11-year-old boy who was dying of AIDS. He was so weak he couldn't come outside, but Santa backed the truck up to the house windows and his parents held him while we sang to him. Then Santa jumped out and visited George. George died 3 days later. Our next stop was an older couple whose son had committed suicide a few months before. With our hearts full of love, we sang to this bereaved couple, giving them homemade Christmas cookies afterwards. We caroled for several other families. Then Santa asked the group if we minded making just one more stop. We were all tired, cold, and wishing to return to Santa's house, but begrudgingly agreed to carol again. Santa drove our cold, tired group of carolers to the home of a vital, loving, and very outgoing woman who shared her love with many others. We got out of the truck, tromped across her lawn, and began singing, but got no response. I told my husband it was silly to sing to a dark house with no one answering the door. We didn't even have cookies to share with her. He said he, quote, felt very strongly that we needed to carol there. He asked us to be patient while he ran around to the back of the house. The kids were really cold, standing around, not singing, and getting grumpier by the minute. About 10 minutes later, Santa opened the front door with his arm around a sweet little old lady, and we began caroling again. When we had finished several songs, with tears running down her cheeks, the woman clung to Santa as she thanked us, and Santa took her back inside. After cookies, hot chocolate, and a Christmas movie, everyone went home. Then my husband shared the story of our last caroling stop. Mary, we'll call her Mary, had recently received divorce papers and was in complete shock. After trying to cope with this devastating news, Mary was in the process of ending her life at the very moment when Santa interrupted her. If not for Santa acting on his gut feeling, this woman would no longer have been in this world. Christmas is indeed a time for loving, sharing, caring, and giving. One never knows what the next minute will hold. Here's one that's not a holiday story, but it's a good one, called Dr. Tim, and the person who submitted it called themselves the patient. Over 25 years ago, a friend recommended a doctor to me. The doctor had a private practice, and his office was nearby. Best of all, he favored preventive and natural medicine, important to me as I seemed to be allergic to half the substances known to mankind. Foods, chemicals, dyes, you name it, I'm allergic. I appreciated he was a small business owner, being one myself. I didn't have insurance because 1 month of insurance cost more than I usually spend in 3 years at the doctor. Even 25 years ago, policies for one person were extremely expensive. So I went to see Dr. Tim. He was a great guy, very helpful, very respectful. Afterwards, the gal at the front desk printed out a bill for $80. As I was writing my check, Dr. Tim came up, took the bill, drew a line across it, and wrote in $60. I was floored. "Look," he said, "if we bill an insurance company, it takes an incredible amount of our time, energy, and money. Insurance companies don't pay the full amount of the bill, and it takes a long time for us to be paid. People who pay in the moment deserve to pay less. It's still better for us." "Wow, thanks," I replied. Years later, Doc Tim joined a big medical business in my metro area, in charge of one of their offices. At that big business, still uninsured, I had to pay full price. Then one day the front desk clerk said, "If you're paying today, self-insured, there's 20% off your bill." Amazing. Next time, I told Doc Tim, "Great news on the 20% off." He said, "Let me tell you a story about that. I went to meetings for 2 years, saying that I thought our self-insured customers deserved this. People finally agreed, but the computer guy said they had to change the system to accommodate it. Next meeting, same conversation. Finally, after 2 years, I sent a bill out front with the instructions, 'Take 20% off. Patient is self-pay.' The front desk did just that. Soon my phone lit up with the billing department. 'Why'd you do this?' I told them I did it because they'd been talking about it for years, plenty of time to get it done, and I was going to continue. Within 1 month, the 20% off was in the computers, system-wide, for all our locations. Needless to say, my jaw dropped. One person, one conviction to do what was right, thousands of patients paying a more fair rate, probably still more money than insurance companies paid. Imagine how many people, how many families that would help over the years. It's probably been 10 years. I still don't see the doctor often, but when I do, there's 20% off on my bill. On my behalf, and the thousands of people who don't know the story, thank you, Dr. Tim. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We are doing what I call Good News Week this week, and I'm just basically by myself reading uplifting, positive, nice stories about the people in the world around us, something we don't get in the media very much these days. This is called Just Come Back Later by Guy Slater, who's in Tennessee. My wife and I moved to the Cumberland Plateau of Tennessee in November of 2005 from a large metropolitan area to a very rural area. While moving, we had the help of our adult daughter and our 2-year-old granddaughter. During the hectic days of moving into our new home, we ate out in the local community a lot. One evening, we decided to have dinner at Cindy's Catfish Kitchen. Cindy's is a buffet-style restaurant, all you can eat. It had been a long day of moving boxes and furniture, and tomorrow would see us on the long drive back to our former home for another load, a 1,000-mile long trip. We were all tired, and our granddaughter was cranky to top it all off. But the buffet was great, and we ended our meal feeling rested and relaxed. When I went to pay our bill, card in hand, the waitress cashier told me that Cindy's didn't have the ability to take either credit or debit cards. Being from the big city, using a credit or debit card was the norm. Oops! I had no cash in my pocket, but about 10 miles back down the road I'd seen a bank with an ATM. I told the lady that I would leave my family there and return in a few minutes to pay for our meals. "Oh, y'all don't have to do that," she told me. "You just come back sometime and pay us then." "What? These people had never seen me before, did not know if I would ever return, yet they trusted me to return to pay for 3 adult meals. This is not something that I'd ever encountered in the big city, that's for sure. We've lived here now for almost 6 years, and every single week I see other acts of trust like this happening. It may be a country thing or just plain southern hospitality. Whatever it is, I certainly like it, and I pass on this kindness every chance I get. This one's from a guy in Michigan called This Is For Her, December 2011. Times are tough. They were in 2011, especially in small areas. I drove to a blighted part of the city with boarded-up homes. We were 5 months behind on electric payments, and I'd been calling to delay the shutoff for 1 more week. Twice they delayed payment. At the zeroth hour, I pulled up to the building, preceded by a black woman driving a rusted, crumbling beater that shuddered to a stop. I walked in behind her, cash in hand, and waited in line. My children bounced on chairs nearby. 2 women behind bulletproof acrylic windows took money, but only 1 line moved. Delaying the other line was a long conversation from a young white mother with a baby on her hip. She wore pajamas and a sweater, was good-natured and laughing. "Well, so," she said, "you know how it is. I mean, they just sit there in a pile, right? I don't know where they go. I don't know. I probably lost it," meaning the bill. The woman behind the 2-inch-thick, bulletproof plexiglass nodded, unspeaking. Her nameplate said Ella. The young patron continued, "I mean, I guess the payment plan is good, but that's... how much again?" $50, the woman behind the plexiglass prompted. The young mother said, "Yeah, $50. I mean, 50. And if we miss that today, then what? 50? Ella confirmed, "Yes, 50. The payment plan we arranged." "Boy, how could it be so much?" A long pause. "So what happens if we don't have the..." Ella, $50. "Well, that's when the account needs to be discontinued." The woman with the baby on her hip looked at the floor during this whole conversation, talking in a low voice, but in a silent room of people waiting. She talked as though every second she talked was another second the power stayed on, as though somehow in this circular conversation the situation would resolve itself. Momentarily irritated, one woman was taking so much time, I then felt some shame. I'd just wait calmly. Clearly the young woman with the baby was just buying time. Seconds, moments, avoiding the inevitable. Her power would be shut off in the morning. Slowly the line crawled. My children became more animated and impatient. The woman with the baby kept talking. Then the woman in front of me went up to the counter, the woman who drove the rusted beater. She handed the teller a check. "This is for her," and pointed at the young mother with the baby. The woman who wrote the check left. She beelined to her beater and drove off. The 2 tellers looked at one another confused. One said to the young mother, "Well, I guess, Merry Christmas." The woman with the baby looked at the floor. I don't think she pointed at me. I don't know her. "She paid your electric bill," said a teller. "Next," and the people in line who'd been staring blankly burst out in a joyous murmur. Here's one called Modern Chivalry by The Mom. I'm close to 40, raised old-fashioned, and frequently mourn the loss of a time when people took care of one another. You see the theme here? There's some continuing kind of similarities, huh? I wonder if my 3 sons will be the gentlemen I try to raise them to be. Mid-October 2010, I had to get my youngest son from school drama practice. I buckled my daughter in her car seat and took off like a herd of turtles. First stop, the closest air pump, as I had a tire going flat. I filled the tire with my last dollar. Once out of the gas station, pop, the van jerked, then thump, thump, thump. Sigh, the tire is 100% flat, and I'm out of cash. Okay, I can change a tire. However, the little one has been sick since she was born, and when she's this sick, I can't leave her unattended beyond a couple minutes. I have to be ready to assist her with any problems. AAA phone call done, I wait for my temporary champion in a tow truck and grease-smeared hands to help change the flat. I call my son and husband to inform them of the delay. I put the cell down and get scared half to death. Someone is beating on my window. It's a young African-American man. I freak because where I'm broke down is not the best place for safety. He asks if I need help. I nervously told him I have assistance coming. The area, not the person, made me nervous. He was well-mannered and polite. His response, "Yeah, but I'm here now." I took all the factors into consideration. Sick child, another child stranded, Husband working too far away to help. Van on a busy street, still half an hour wait for the AAA. I thanked him and told him I couldn't afford to pay him. He chortled and told me he didn't ask for money. Together we worked to replace the tire with the spare. He did the majority of it since I had to watch my daughter. In under 15 minutes, he had me ready to drive. When I asked him his name, he said, Tracy. I thanked him appreciatively for the help he'd given. He walked off before I could say anything else. I passed him a minute later and waved thank you again as he smiled and waved back. I seriously thought chivalry was dead. Here a young man, young enough to be my son, stopped to help a complete stranger out of the blue for no reason at all. Now I know I might not ever get to tell Tracy's family they should be proud of their boy, but I can put this story out there in hopes it might reach them. I can be grateful for Tracy showing me something I needed to learn and giving me a little more hope about today's young men. Thank you, Tracy. Your actions meant a great deal to me. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We are doing what I call Good News Week. I'm just reading uplifting, positive, nice stories about the people in the world around us. The next one's from another site called Good News Network. It's at goodnewsnetwork.org. According to a new report released by the National Center for Family and Marriage Research, more and more American couples are choosing to stay together through sickness and health instead of choosing divorce. And this is dated November 2016. The national divorce average has fallen to 16.9 divorces per year per 1,000 married women, the lowest it's been since the 70s. Apart from divorces peaking at 22.8 in 1980 and 20 in 2008, the percentages have been on a fairly consistent decline ever since. Hawaii had the least divorces per capita, resulting in 11 out of every 1,000 marriages per year. Washington, D.C. had the highest, with a two-year streak of 30 divorces per 1,000 marriages. The decline could result in fewer people getting married to begin with. However, the rate of marriages has been fairly stable since 2010. Utah, the state with the highest amount of marriages at 61.3 per 1,000 women per year, has a fairly average divorce rate of 21, much less than the 50-50 success odds American weddings have been given in the past. So that's good news. Another one from the Good News Network. This is also from late November 2016. During a ceremony in Washington, D.C. in late November, the U.S. Department of Interior announced it was canceling 15 energy exploration leases on land that is sacred to Native Americans. The Badger II Medicine Area is an expanse of wilderness stretching along the Montana mountain line that is home to the Blackfeet people. For the last 10,000 years, Blackfeet members have found cultural identity in the 130,000 acres of the Badger II Medicine land. The tribe has vehemently protested and opposed the land leases since they were signed without their consultation almost 30 years ago. The oil and natural gas company in question, Devon Energy Corporation, acquired the land leases after merging with another company. Company President David Hager surrendered the land after acknowledging that the pristine landscape was not theirs to invade. The process of fracking that would have gleaned the natural gas could also have harmed the water supply, which is in close proximity to the leased parcel. There are two land leases left on the Holy Land that are still owned by other energy companies, but the U.S. Department of the Interior Secretary, Sally Jewell, is determined to prevent them from drilling on the Blackfeet territory. Hope that determination holds. This is the right action to take on behalf of current and future generations, said Secretary Jewell. Today's action honors Badger II Medicine's rich cultural and natural resources and recognizes the irreparable impacts that oil and gas development would have on them. So these from Good News Network are clearly news items. Here's another one that's a story from heroicstories.com. It's called What Courage Really Is, and it's submitted by someone who calls himself The Counselor from Texas. I'm a child counselor for an organization providing therapeutic foster care for children who've experienced abuse or neglect by their families. One of my former clients now lives with her grandparents in another state. She was placed into foster care with her two older sisters because her mother's boyfriend sexually molested all three of them. At the time of this story, she was 8 years old, about 4 feet tall, weighed 41 pounds, and looked like a little elf. When her abuser went on trial, the district attorney tried him on charges against this child only because she got the very worst of the abuse. She returned to our state to testify, spending 2 hours on the stand recounting in excruciating detail everything that he did to her over 2 years. She didn't back down when the defense lawyer tried to rattle her during cross-examination. Instead, she announced that she knew he was trying to trick her, and he better knock it off. The investigating police officers, the doctor who examined her, the police examiner, her former foster mother, her grandparents, and I also testified. The jury took 30 minutes to convict. My client's sister testified to his abuse of her during the penalty phase to establish a pattern, and the jury gave him 30 years. The district attorney found 2 prior felony convictions for aggravated assault, which this abuser had lied about, adding another 5 years to his sentence for aggravated perjury. After sentencing, this tiny girl amazed us all. When she entered foster care, she was so scared of her abuser she could barely even speak his name. But after the verdict, she informed her former foster mother that she had something to say to the perpetrator. "You need to help me find a way to do that," she said. The foster mother talked to the district attorney, who talked to the judge. The judge said this was unprecedented. She'd never had a victim in any sexual assault case want to make a victim statement, but nothing legally prevented it, so she agreed. After the jury announced the abuser's sentence, this little girl stood up in the witness stand, looked straight at her abuser, and said, "I'm really sorry you have to go to jail, but you deserve it for what you did to me. I'm really happy to know that you're never going to be able to hurt me again, and that's all I have to say to you." Everybody in the room, with the exception of the defendant and his family and lawyer, was in tears by the end of her statement. We were all so proud of her. She made it possible for justice to be done that day. She faced her abuser bravely, in a way that few adults have the courage to do. From the look of it, this little child is going to be just fine. Seeing her on the stand that day made it clear to me exactly what courage really is. Here's another one from the Good News Network, again in November 2016. For elderly or disabled veterans who are unable to travel, there are some sacred tributes to their service that they will never be able to visit, like the new World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. But thanks to a recently formed nonprofit called Honor Everywhere, they can now experience standing amidst the monumental site by using a virtual reality headset. The organization's founder, Sarah Hill, created Honor Everywhere in honor of her late grandfather, a World War II veteran, who was never fit enough to travel to the memorial. Now they're providing that service to ex-servicemen everywhere, free of charge. The virtual reality experience is viewed with special goggles, which are brought to a veteran's bedside, wheelchair, or assisted living center, says Honor Everywhere's website. These short films create immersive experiences for terminally ill and aging veterans using stereoscopic 360 3D video. Regardless of their physical location, veterans are able to experience the World War II Memorial, the Iwo Jima Memorial, and Arlington National Cemetery as if they were there in person. Well, that's all I've got time for today on Good News Week. I hope you've enjoyed that, and I plan to continue occasionally doing a Good News Week show. So if you want to give me some feedback on this, go ahead at AmericanVarietyRadio.com. You can email me at court@AmericanVarietyRadio.com. Thanks to all of you for listening, and I hope you have a good holiday season. And I also hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.